Today is the 9th of Kislev, December 5th, and we are starting Book 3 in Sefer Chinuch, and that is the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim. So this parsha has a lot of mitzvahs in it, 51 mitzvot, 13 positive, 38 negative. And that is the parsha of Kedoshim to you. You should be holy, so there should be a lot of mitzvahs in this one.
13 positive, how many negative?
And 38 negative precepts. So Rav Hirsch has a lot to say on how the parsha starts, and it's just interesting to think about that the parsha that says, be holy, how does it start with mitzvah? So it starts with honoring your parents. That's number one. So that seems to be a prerequisite for holiness, is that recognition of who brought you into the world. So hakaras hatov, right? Because the mitzvah of honoring and respecting, revering, caring for your parents is based in recognizing who gave you life. So you need to understand that first before you can be holy. And then, just as the quick overview, then not to turn astray with idol worship, which we'll talk about. That's a little different than the other idol worships that we've looked at. This being not to turn astray after idol worship, not just to not idol worship, right? Which we'll look at in a minute. 2:14, not to make an idol for oneself or for anyone else. So that kind of goes as it goes with. And then you might wonder why this one is stuck in here, which hopefully we'll get to answer that. The prohibition of eating leftover meat of sacrifices, which is called notar, which will connect with pagul. And then...
what's pagul?
Pagul. So we'll go to that in just a minute. Okay. Yeah. And then the following mitzvah, which we're going to do next week as a group, but just to see the way the parsha opens up, the following one is the mitzvah of leaving the edge of the one's field unreaped for the poor, peah, and it continues with some of those, not to fully reap your field and not to, so tzedakah, right? So these are the opening mitzvot of the parsha of Kedoshim. So it's just interesting to see the progression of those. Okay, so starting with parents. So 2:12 is the mitzvah of reverence for father and mother. So that's yirat av ve'em. So yira, because we have a mitzvah of kavod, honoring, and a mitzvah of yira, reverence, or fear. So here it's translated as reverence, but, excuse me, and when I type up my sheets, I always use the translation that's right in the book. I'm not retranslating. So yira, in this case, fear. So fear and honor. Right, so number 33 is the precept of honoring father and mother. And so I brought that too, just to look at the contrast between the two. What are the differences? Where is that one? 33 is in the first book.
What are the differences? 33?
So 33 is honoring father and mother. And 2:12 is reverence for father and mother, right? Oh, okay. So reverence is basically includes the negative ones. Not to, let's see what it says here. Third paragraph. Among the laws of the precept, there is what the sages of blessed memory taught. How far should reverent fear of a father and mother go? Even if they beat him and spat in his face, he should not put them to shame. Nevertheless, the sages ordained that a man should not strike his grown son, because there is not a matter of the element of don't put a stumbling block before the blind. So we know that that's a literal and figurative mitzvah. Right, not to put a stumbling block before the blind. So you shouldn't strike somebody who's not permitted to strike you back. Right, so that would be a child. Today, actually, so this is a grown child you shouldn't strike. Today, in my parenting day, which isn't that long ago, but 20 years ago, we were taught not to strike after 3 because it's a stumbling block. Because after 3, after age 3, if you strike at age 4 or 5, they might not hit you back right then, although they might hit you back right then, but they're still not a bar mitzvah then. But they might hold on to the resentment and hit you later. And today, generally, we're taught not to strike at all.
Never.
At all. So I think there would be the exception for the running into the street, touching the hot stove kind of thing. And that's it, not for chutzpah, right, just for shock value for the tiniest of tinies before they can really get it. You know, but just for straight up training for very, very young, but not once it's a thought out educational thing for chutzpah or something like that, which used to be acceptable to hit for. It's not anymore. That's not actually what I wanted to say. Okay, what constitutes reverent fear? One should not sit in his parents' place, should not speak in his place, and should not contradict his words. So those are all nots. Don't do these things. That shows reverent fear for your parent. right? So not sitting in their place, not speaking. It's interesting. So not speak in his place, does that mean not? I think what that means, not speaking in his place, means to not speak when they should be speaking, and sometimes to not agree with their words. So, which sounds strange, but if you agree, doesn't mean you can't say, oh, I see, I understand, I get it, that's right. But it means to, in a conversation, when a parent might say, and so the right thing to do is blah, 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 the child shouldn't say, that's right, he's right, and blah, blah, blah. You're not supposed to do that, because if you have the right to say that's right, it means you have the right to say that's wrong. Who are you to agree or disagree with a parent? So there is something about
ever.
That.
I mean, what about,
ever?
What about, you know, as an adult, that's what I was just gonna ask. You know, and you're having a political conversation or you know.
Right, so there's ways to do it. So the way you're supposed to be respectful about it, and so one of the ways to do it is say, is it possible that, or I have understood, or what I read is,
right.
Rather than saying, nuh-uh. Whatever, right? So we are supposed to be particularly respectful. So I think I told the story before, but it's so cute. So is it possible that is very commonly taught to children as a way to, you know, like let's say a parent, because sometimes it happens, a parent comes in and says it's raining cats and dogs, but the parent's back is to the window and the sun just came out. So the kid is not allowed to say, no, it's not.
The sun's out.
They are allowed to say, is it possible that it may have stopped raining and its sun is shining now? Is it possible that?
How successful
that,
are we, right? With training our children to be that polite,
okay,
and respectful?
Right. Oh, so that's what I was going to say. So in the Torah community, yes. Yeah, so here's the story, okay? So Rabbi Senior Schwab is hosting his Junior Schwab family for Shabbos lunch, or the opposite, whatever. The Senior Schwabs are sitting with the Junior Schwabs for Shabbos, right? And so Rabbi Meir Schwab, the grandfather, you know, there's a lot of grandkids, and occasionally he mixes up a name, as even parents will do. So he one of the kids, he tells Shimmy to pass the salt or whatever, but he calls him Moshe. And he says, Moshe, can you pass the salt? And so Shimmy looks at him and says, is it possible that my name is Shimmy?
Oh, that's so funny. As for the rest of us, we're generally
right.
Not successful.
So it's possible to train that.
Possible,
but it takes a lot of work. But it's not that it's not possible. It is possible.
Well, the other idea about Yirat Hashem, fear of God, and the sphere of reverence of parents, is that we also look to God as our parent too, and that's kind of in this,
it's
the
sort
same
of a,
metaphor for, you know, having the same kind of fear or reverence from parents as we would to Hashem.
Right. So it's supposed to teach us, but it is on a lower level, really,
right.
Because it's not awe. We're not commanded to have awe like we are of Hashem. That yira, because yira does mean awe and reverence and fear. So with parents, it's really fear. It's reverent. Fear, but it's not awe. It's not like with Hashem where you're really supposed to have that awe, which it can be mixed in with fear. You're not supposed to be scared of your parents. That's not what it means. It means you should behave in these ways where you have that reverence. So it just depends. That's why I think why it was translated that way. It's reverence. It's not meant to be fear. You shouldn't be walking the room shuddering because your parents are there.
Right.
And neither should you feel that way about Hashem, although you should feel some fear of Hashem. Hashem can do stuff to
judgment.
You that, yeah, there's stuff
respect.
That...
Respect.
There's respect, and but there's a little more.
More than that.
There is more with Yira. Now, with Kavod, Mitzvah 33, that's more of the positive things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what constitutes this honor? To provide food and drink, clothing and raiment, and to take them in and lead them out. So that means caring for
like
them. Well, so as
taking
they age...
And leaving out.
Well, taking them in and leading them out.
Leading,
so leading them out,
okay.
Right? Escort and attend to them.
Okay,
that's what it means.
Okay,
so you know, no. So it would be a positive commandment. Like when you see, you know, in our community, we have a beautiful example of that, of Lucy Prenzlau and how she's tended to by her two daughters, right? So they trade off on Shabbases. She'll stay with the Erlangers, or she's right across the street from the Krauses. But they go over there and tend her, and occasionally the Erlangers will move in with her for Shabbos. Let's say if the Krauses who are away across the street are away. So, but they take her, and then they will lead her, you know, hold her elbow as she walks and take her to shul and take her back and tend to her. That is this, under this kavod. That's not yira.
Right.
That's kavod. So, and making sure that she's fed and she's clothed, and, you know, and there's all kinds of halachas with that. Whose money does that have to come out of? So apparently you're permitted to take that out of the parents' money as long as they have money. And after that, you, the child is required to do that, even to the fact that they need to go door to door to get the money to take care of their parent. They're not allowed to say, I'm out of money, so I'm done. You know, it is their responsibility to make sure that their parent is fed and cared for to the best of their ability. And as we mentioned before, because we did look at 33 before, that if the parent goes nuts and is really difficult, whatever it could be, later stages of Alzheimer's or whatever it is, and the child is unable to treat them respectfully because whatever, there's chemical clashes, just not working, right? Then it doesn't mean that they're off the hook, but it means that they can now hire somebody. They can find somebody who will do a good job, right? It doesn't have to be them.
Or probably in this day and age, if you're not physically able to be there.
Right, you know, right.
Because of distance or...
Right, and they have all those concierge doctors now in Florida. It's a nice thing to be able to have somebody who will actually look in properly and take care of a parent. Okay. 2:13, not to turn astray after idol worship in thought or word. And it's interesting that he translated it this way, because let's look at the Hebrew. Shelo lifnot achar avodah zarah lo b'machshava v'lo b'dibur v'lo b'habata. So there's really three, and here he only says two, thought or word. So, and it's shelo lifnot. Do not turn towards avodah zarah, not in your thoughts, not in your speech, and not in your glance. Habit is to glance or to look at something. So you're not supposed to stare at idols. So this is not even don't do avodah zarah. This is don't even start. Don't even turn towards something. So it's similar to, we just went through all those do not uncover the ervas of, you know, all these different relationships, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Except for there's a difference with the nida. With the nida, it says don't come close to uncovering the erva of a nida. But all the other ones with the mother, with the sister, is just don't uncover the erva of, right? So this is different from the other don't worship avodah zarahs because it says low leaf note. Don't even turn towards it. Don't even come close to it. So so it's the very beginnings. You're not even there yet. It's not that you're thinking you're going to go worship idols, but you're not supposed to look at, so gazing, contemplating at idols or reading about other religions, or why they think other things, or even looking at the stars and the sun and wondering if they could be providing something outside of Hashem, that kind of thing. You're not supposed to allow those thoughts to go anywhere. A thought, now, as Rabbi Shragi Friedman said, and I love his quote, you can't control if a bird flies over your head, but you can control if it makes a nest in your hair. Right? So, right? Yeah, I think it's a great quote. So that this too, you're allowed to look at the heavens. That's great. But should you start to realize that you're contemplating, so stop, right? You're not supposed to think that way at all. So not, and gazing, you're not supposed to be gazing. So it's one thing if you're going to the Asian market to pick up whatever kosher noodles they sell there, but you should not be stopping past that little statue they have in the entryway, you know, with the little fruit and, yeah, uh-huh, not allowed.
Not even to look at it, not in the context of what it is, but just...
I think so.
So does that mean
that...
Does that mean that you can't or should not, like, go into a museum?
Or
and
church?
Well,
church, yes.
Museum, right.
Well,
a church,
museum,
correct,
example,
you're not supposed to go into.
It has, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen in museums examples of Asian art or
right.
whatever.
I think that's a real shiloh, actually.
Or, for example, how about the Russian Orthodox? You know, a lot of Russian art in particular from a particular period of time was very
all icons, right. I think that's a shiloh. I don't know the answer to that, but that is a shiloh because,
I mean, when you're not looking at it at all in the context, I mean, gazing, I mean, I guess to me that's more like, oh, gee, aren't the stars and everything
right.
pretty?
Right, so that's fine.
I mean, they're pretty.
Right, so that's fine.
You know?
And sometimes gazing at art is pretty, and sometimes you don't even know. You know,
I
hear Orthodox people humming Christmas carols. They don't know those are Christmas carols. You know, like they just don't know. You know, and I have a hard time. I go into stores during this season. I know all the words. Yeah. So even if they're not playing the words, I hate, you know, like, you know, and then I'm just driving around thinking, should a Torah teacher really be thinking, oh, come, are ye faithful, or whatever it is. Like, you know, that's not what I want going through my mind.
La, 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 la.
Right. So falala is not as bad as like some of the other, you know, phrases in those songs I really don't want to be thinking.
But, you know, so I mean, I think that's...
So the problem is that once they go in, you are thinking that. You know, just the because you're creating a battery of stuff that's there for you to draw upon later, and you never know. So that's why we're extra cautious. I mean, I was just thinking yesterday, I made nachos for my husband. I made a nice cheese sauce, poured it around, and then we sat together, and I had one, and he was like, mmm. I said, mmm, these are really good. This is much better than I thought. And then I thought, mmm, good. Mmm, good. That's what everybody knows, right? Campbell's soup is mmm. How old is that commercial?
I never think. See, maybe it's because I have a simple mind. Those things do not recur in my mind.
Well, I mean, for example, I mean, can't you just look at some architectural things like the Mayan pyramids or the temples of Angkor Wat or any of these things which are also connected with a form of religion as purely architecture? Can you admire it just as a culture, an architecture, an object to art?
Right.
Or you're not even allowed to even
It's an excellent
there?
Question. So I don't know enough to answer that right now. I know just from my learning in Rambam, so I am not rendering a psak at all, but I did learn Hilchot Avodah Zarah in the Rambam. Mm-hmm. And so there is a concept there that of how you can be mevatel a site or an object of Avodah Zarah. So how you make it into a not Avodah Zarah thing.
Right.
So the person that worships it can say, let's say, I don't know, somebody collects statues of Mary or whatever, and they have one in their shrine, right? But now they found a beautiful one. They got rich and they bought a gold one, right? And so they don't need that porcelain one anymore, or that clay one that their two-year-old made, whatever, and they were using that one. So now they can say, I no longer care about this one, want this one, think it's worth anything, I'm done with it, and they can chuck it. Now you can fish it out of the garbage can and use it as a paperweight because they rejected it as that. So there are things like that, because especially during a time when people really did recycle, they recycled columns to rebuild other buildings.
Right,
can you use the column of an ancient temple for an office building, a home, or whatever? Are you permitted? Mm-hmm. Right. So those were questions at the time. So it really depends on, you know, many different things. So, but I think the reason why I brought up the Campbell soup thing is because that's got to be 40 years old
well,
in my head.
And also it's a very sort of a nothing.
Right.
Kind of a, I mean, it's not, it doesn't have any implications.
Have
like
none.
Religious.
None at all. But the point is.
I know, exactly. No.
Right. But the point is that the whatever you look at, whatever you think about, whatever you read, whatever you, it's all there. And so we do need to be careful with what we put in. And one of my grandmother's famous sayings, I don't have a lot of expressions, you have a lot from your grandmother, from your history, but one of hers that she used to tell me all the time was, don't put rocks in your egg basket. So she would say that all the time when I was reading Archie's comics, mm-hmm. Richie Rich's, all those things. Don't put rocks in your egg basket, right? So, and she told me,
don't fill up
your mind with garbage when you want to fill your mind up with stuff that's important. Uh-huh. So that's what this is. It's not, obviously, there's enough room for all of it. But the truth is, things come up. And so when you've seen negative images, when you've had negative thoughts, when you've read novels with scenes of romance, that can come up when you're being romantic. And you might not want that to come up when you're being romantic. So you do need to be careful with what you put in, because then it's there. So I think that's what this is saying. Don't stray after it. Don't think about it. And even reading it, you know, I mean... in other books, if it has scenes of Avodah Zarah, so you don't want to be reading that because you never know when that can come up. Or when you could incorporate that somewhere. You might say, wow, that way of prayer is really nice. Let me try that inside my own thing. And then it's Avodah Zarah. It's not okay. You know, so, and you never know what's what. So it's better to, that's what this is saying, that even in thought, we're not supposed to go there.
This is like the don't even go there.
Right. It is. Exactly. That's exactly what this is.
Well, and what's interesting is that it's mentioned again and mm-hmm. again and again, mm-hmm. which shows that we're so tempted.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'll just read.
Temptation to look for a symbol.
Once it's in
symbol.
There to get it out is just next to you.
But it's not that. It's not just that. it's the building the nest, because apparently it's very easy. So that's what, on the second page, on page 7. So this injunction, i.e., which prohibits thinking about an idol, was repeated elsewhere. For it is stated, take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve, etc. In other words, if your heart will ponder on it very much, it will be a motivation for you to turn away from the right path and occupy yourself with its worship. Then it was stated further about this subject, and beware lest you lift up your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, you be drawn away and worship them. So that's a straight-up pasuk in Deuteronomy 4:19. Here the sense is not that a man should not lift up his head and look at the heavens. It's rather meant to convey that one should not contemplate them with the eye of the heart. That's an interesting phrase. With the eye of the heart, to know their power and significance, which means, in effect, in order to worship them. So, as it is stated elsewhere, and lest you inquire about their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? So will I do likewise. That's where we have to be super careful. Thus, the writ restrains us from inquiring about the nature of its worship, because all this is a causative factor to go astray about it. So, some would say, and I think we've mentioned before, even studying comparative religions, it can be a problem. So, we have to study that very carefully, not to go too far studying something else. I think we do have to, and again, that's halachic. We should need to ask clear guidance on it, but I think we can arm ourselves with the information to not be influenced by missionaries, etc., that kind of thing. But to just say, you know, gosh, that seems like such an interesting Indian document of, you know, I forgot how you pronounce all those, the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, thank you. To just go reading that might not be the wisest choice for a Jew, and it might even be usher.
I think that what's interesting is, if you think about it, and I'm not sure that I know this, but we must be one of the only religions that doesn't have a concrete symbol to worship.
Right, you know, we are.
Catholics worship Mary.
The cross. Yeah.
You know, the Buddha,
the Buddhist. Islam. Well, what is Islam?
I don't know.
Islam doesn't. Islam is considered cleanly monotheistic.
Islam is the closest. Mm-hmm. I remember the rabbi said repeatedly, it is the closest to Judaism of any religion.
I mean, they march around it.
They do, but they don't worship it.
Well, the Catholics will tell you they don't worship Mary. They revere her for her position in the kingdom.
Yeah, but they still pray to Mary, though.
They ask her to intercede.
Right.
Well,
but they're praying to her. Yeah, it is.
It's a concrete. Or the cross,
for Jews, Catholicism is not monotheistic.
That a priest would say to you, "We're not worshiping her."
Right. It's true. A priest would say that. But for Jews, we would say that's a problem. For Jews, Christianity is a problem. But according to the Jews, non-Catholic Christianity is monotheistic for Gentiles.
For them.
For Gentiles. But for, not that a Jew would be permitted to worship in an Islamic way, but a Jew is permitted to go into a mosque because that is very cleanly monotheistic. A church is a very serious problem. Depends on the type of church, but the ones with the great art are the big problems. The Protestant ones aren't so problem, they're all boring looking, so...
And gorgeous architecture.
Right.
The big arches.
Okay, 2:14, to make no idol for oneself or for anyone else. So you're not allowed to worship it. You're not allowed to be the craftsperson. Right. So it's a separate Easter. So this is for you. Of course, you can't make it for you, but it's a separate Easter on top of a separate prohibition on top of not being able to worship it is actually fashioning it. But you can't even do it for somebody else. You're great at carving wood, and somebody comes to you and says, "Would you please carve me a Madonna?" No, you're not permitted.
I couldn't work in a factory that's making Diana. The statue of Diana. Mm-hmm.
Right. Not allowed to do that.
Right.
So, and here's a verse here. Cursed be the man who makes a graven or molten image and sets it up in secret. All kinds of things, secret and public. You're not allowed to facilitate. And it's particularly because Avodah Zarah is also something that non-Jews aren't permitted to do. So you're helping them do something that's usher for them. So that prohibition's enforced in every place and every time for both man and woman. So, right.
Well, but this is interesting. It says if you make it and you make money from it, and if I'm reading this right, it says objects for serving an idol, whether it is a heathen's or an Israelite's, do not become forbidden until they are used. If someone makes an idol, even though he receives whiplashes, the benefit of his wages is permissible.
On
page 9.
Paragraph.
But you're going to do whiplashes, so that's not.
Yeah, but I mean that means that you can actually
still make
keep the money.
Let's say you're a wholesaler, right? Mm-hmm. So you are making them and you sell them to the wholesaler, but they haven't yet been sold retail to be bought, to be used.
So you can't do it, but if you made money from it, you could keep your money.
Right, you still get whiffed for making it.
It's a little bizarre, but okay.
A heck of a livelihood.
Right. So really, when things like this come up, I mean, it is very tempting to think about the person who's willing to take the beatings in order
to get the money.
But that's not actually it. It's the theoretical, what part is usser and when does it become, when has the avera been completed?
Right.
You know, where you wouldn't even be able to get benefit from the money from it, or different levels of it. That's what it's really discussing. So, yeah. But
can't
it can sound
can't
weird.
It.
That,
it
yeah.
sound weird, though.
Yeah, like, it's better just not to do it. Right.
Yeah, it's like the, I don't know if you, did anybody ever hear the 2,000-year-old man? That whole Mel Brooks thing a million years ago. Yeah. So he asks, he interviews him. He says, what's your business? He said, well, they used to make Stars of David. He said, how'd you do that? He said, we had a factory where everybody held points and they ran together into the middle of the room. To try to fuse them through the pressure. So a lot of injuries. So much easier when they invented the cross.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, man.
Right, okay. All right, 2:15. The prohibition of eating leftover meat of sacrifices. Okay, so this category is called notar, which means leftover. The root is like yoter, like too much. Yoter mi dai, that's too much. So yoter means more than. Notar, same root. And so that's leftover. And this is related to, but a separate prohibition from the prohibition against pigul. Pagul, that's 144 in book 2. All right, did I in the right place? Right.
Right,
okay, good. Okay, so pagul is the category. Here it's translated as vile meat in English, but what causes the fact that it's vile is lack of proper intention. So it becomes pagul if the Kohen didn't have appropriate intention upon sacrificing it. So if the Kohen, while sacrificing it, and this is for somebody else, but then there's certain procedures and how it's going to be eaten and disposed of. If the Kohen was thinking, I'm not planning on eating my portion today. I'm going to wait until the third day because that's when I have company coming over or whatever it is, right? You're not supposed to eat it on the third day. So you have today and tomorrow or whatever it is. There's a certain time zone in which you're permitted to eat it. And after that, you're not. So if he's thinking, I'm not planning on eating it until then when it's forbidden, then the whole sacrifice is called pagul, and you're not permitted to partake of it at all.
So then it becomes the legal concept ab initio to the beginning.
Right, it does.
It affects
the whole
from
thing.
The very beginning.
It does. Well, in this case, it is from the beginning, because it's his intention from the beginning. So it's not that it's probably not that legal concept, because not that after the fact he decided to wait, or he ate it on the third day, which makes it forbidden from the beginning. It's that from the beginning,
intention.
As he is killing it, he has the incorrect intention. So that makes it pagul. The leftover meat is it was sacrificed correctly, intent was correctly, but now it's the third day. Are you permitted to eat from that? Right. So, so you're not. So they're both forbidden, but they're both. It's interesting. I think Rafer says they're both crimes of thought in a way. So we'll look at the notar in just a second. But first we want to look at the concept of gzera shava, which we've looked at before, but just to get it clearer. So what a gzera shava is where you learn shava means shavez, equivalent. So there's
something
equivalent in the two verses that makes this the same, right? So you learn one thing from the other. So they both say, let's look at what they both say. Where are they?
For what the altar consumed by fire and what man consumes by eating would both be signified by the expression of eating.
Right, but that's not the gezeirah shavah, because that would have to do with the punishment. So here in Leviticus 7:18 says, and if any shall be at all eaten, the soul of that eats it shall bear his iniquity.
And kareth, cut off.
Right, and that means and that denotes karet. Mm-hmm. And the way that we get it is through a gezerah shavah, identity of two of terms in two verses, right? So, but here it says in Leviticus 19:6-8, if anything remains until the third day, it is a vile thing; it will not be accepted, and everyone who eats it shall bear his iniquity. So bear his iniquity, right? That's the same. Oh, bearing the iniquity there shall bear its iniquity. Because he has profaned a holy thing of the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off. So here in this verse, it doesn't say that soul shall be cut off. In the first one, for Pagul. In the second one, for Notar, it does say that. But they both say shall bear its iniquity.
So using bear its iniquity,
we get to both means the both off. Get karet. Right. That's a gezerah shavah. So there is some equation of the two, however, not enough to make them the same isur. They are two separate isurim, two separate prohibitions. So I guess it would be possible for it to be the same piece of meat, right? You could get two separate isurs on the same piece of meat. So if a korban was offered that is pagul because the kohen had inappropriate intentions, and then the third day after it was offered, that could be pagul and notar. Right?
Right.
So that would be two separate Esurs and the one piece of meat, although you're punished just with the one. They don't add up for the punishment, but they're both, so it's two separate things. Let's see. So why are they both, let's see if I can find where I put in the chumash.
Two negative precepts.
Right. Let's see if I kept my place here in the Hirsch.
Right.
Aw.
Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, good.
It says in Deuteronomy, you shall not eat any abominable thing.
Right, so that's an additional.
Okay.
Because they're considered abominable once Hashem says not to eat them. So why are they abominable? So Rav Hirsch explains that when we bring shlamim, those shalim offerings, in the feedings of our undisturbed happiness, no trace of that heathen erroneous idea may be present, as if it were necessary to placate the deity jealous of our undisturbed happy condition by giving something of it up to him out of our own free will. So shlamim are to be consumed. That's why you're not supposed to leave over meat. We're supposed to eat the whole thing. We shouldn't think that just because we're happy and we're offering something up, that there's any kind of a concept that we have to appease God to maintain our happiness. Which is very easy within the multiple cultures around us, certainly at that time. But even the concept sort of could possibly border on occasionally negative things would be that poo-poo ayin hara thing, right? That we want to make sure that we shouldn't enjoy something too much. That's not Jewish.
Yeah, that's right.
That's not Jewish, right? So it's not Jewish to say...
That's what the whole Hasidic movement was, to revive... The joy.
Right. Well, that for sure. But we want to make sure that we don't come into any kind of pagan idea that if we have real pleasure, we need to take from that pleasure and give it to our God, some of it at least, so that our pleasure will be protected. That's not the Jewish idea. So that's why it's saying with the shlamim, korban shlamim, the whole happy offerings that we give, we're supposed to eat it and not leave any over. We shouldn't have that crime of thought, right, that God is supposed to get some of this to appease him.
But we're not supposed to do excess.
Correct, but this is a korban. So we're engaged. So
you just have to have enough people around.
Right, yeah, you do. Or you burn the rest of it. Let's see, how does it work? I don't even understand how all the korbanot work, but you are supposed to eat, let's see.
If you can't finish it, then you have to burn.
It's not to satisfy God's requirements, but our own, that the offering is to be brought, lirtzon chem tizbehuhu, that's the pasuk, for your own free will you should offer it. The purpose of our offering is to be an expression of our vow to make and keep intentions. That's that type of offering. And so little is... let's see. so I should just copy this of Hirsch for you to look at. B'yom zivcha zvachem yochal. That's the verse. On the day of your offering, that kind of offering, a happy one, you should eat it. So you should eat it on that day. And so little is death or destruction the meaning of the... And so little is death or destruction the meaning of the slaughter... of the offering, that achila, the joyful eating of the offering in the presence of God in one's own homely family circle, belongs essentially to the objects of the offerings. So meaning it's that this kind of offering has nothing to do with death or destruction. This kind of offering has only to do with the joy and the family eating together and the celebration. So you shouldn't add into it a concept of death or destruction. And so leaving something over would add that in. And you're not supposed to do that.
Although we do have a symbol of death and destruction at weddings when we break the glass, right?
Yes, it's interesting. So let's look at that for a second. So we definitely do that. Today it's easily translated into a symbol of destruction. But it's actually a little bit deeper than that. So we do, at our moment of peak joy, not want to experience peak joy, because we do want to keep in mind that God doesn't have a home, so here we are establishing a home. So we just want to remember that God is homeless. So, but how do we do that? So we break the glass, right? So it's interesting. Today you can buy... Today sometimes people break a light bulb. It's really easy to break. Somebody told me she just got married. She bought a glass that's meant for breaking at weddings. It took a lot of work to break it, actually. Right, she got it. It was colorful, so you could put it in the Lucite, right? So people have lost what it is. So and especially in today's wealthy world, it's so hard for us to relate to, a broken glass. Like, oh, so it's a pain in the neck to sweep up. But are we really crying over broken glass? So let's just choose an Orifer's crystal goblet, right? If that breaks, how do you feel? Oh, there's a little pang of loss there. Orifer's crystal, that's expensive and beautiful, right? So it makes you feel a sense of loss. We do physical things to cause feelings. So you're supposed to feel a sense of loss over that broken thing, where you can now say, oh, right, I don't feel the loss over the temple. I had to do something to make me feel loss. So I broke that thing that's of value so I could feel loss. So I can now take that feeling and put it where it's supposed to go, over a sense of loss over the temple. I should feel a sense of things aren't whole or complete. So that's why we break it, really. But that's really lost today when we just break the thinnest glass or the littlest or a light bulb, just so there is that
sound.
You know, right. So there's that sound. Right. Just for the mazel tov. You know, they say that the reason why the guy breaks the glass under the chuppah is because that's his last chance to put his foot down. So anyway, the idea is to access the feelings with that. So so let me just read Rav Hirsch's paragraph here. Right, you're supposed to eat it in your own, because he connects Pagul and Notar here. Okay, so you're supposed to eat it happily in your own family. It is in this that the meaning of the zvicha, that kind of offering, really culminates, and therefore the zvicha and the achila, the eating, must be kept in close connection in time. So you're supposed to offer it and eat it happily right away. Not only that which is actually left uneaten beyond the fixed time, notar, has to be burnt, but even, tracking problems here, but even if only ha'achol yochal, even if at the moment of zvicha, even at the moment of sacrifice, there should be only a thought, only the intention of separating the eating from the offering in time, machshevet chutz lezmano, meaning you're thinking outside of the time, you're thinking when you're offering it, I want to offer it today because it's convenient, but the truth is I can't eat it until my whole family gets here on day three, right? You have that thought, not permitted. The whole offering becomes pagul. So that's in your own thought, not just the kohen, right? And with notar, any meat which has actually become separated from the offering by lapse of time, or with pagul, that which has become rejected only by intended separation of the zvicha from the achila, of the offering from the eating, the gravest desecration of kudshim, of holy things, is punishable by karet, has been done. Right? So this is all intent things. Notar, that which is left over, that is to say, eating without offering, or having that time separated, is the sanctioning of uncontrolled enjoyment of one's senses. So you're eating it, if you're eating that yummy thing, apart from when you offered it, so then you are just eating because it's yummy, not because you gave the offering. And pagul, that is offering without eating, right? So there's the two things, right? Is the idolatrous polytheistic elilim delusion. Both are blasphemous. Both are perversions of God's holy things into their very opposite meaning, and anyone doing so is chilul kodesh Hashem, is is desecrating God's holy things. Okay, so you see that's the connection between Pagul and Notar. Pagul is they're both time separations. One is offering, separating from the beginning, the offering and the eating, and the other is the opposite way, separating the eating from the offering. And they're both forbidden because they both go into different places. Good. Okay. And so, all right. So, before you go, so the concept that's binding all this together is thought, right? Thought is what makes Pagul things Pagul. Thought is what informs our actions for the honoring and the reverence of our parents. Thought is the problem in the turning, beginning to turn astray. Mm-hmm. So today's theme is thought, and that we should all have a week of positive, healthy, growthful thoughts, and make sure that we save ourselves from negative, destructive thoughts.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.